Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, September 18th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Judd Slivka. We've got a lot to talk about this week, and we're going to spend a good portion of the program looking at media behaviors. We'll look at some of the highs and lows of Monday's mass shooting at the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard. We'll talk about what happens when a news organization publishes images it doesn't have rights to, specifically a photo used in a BuzzFeed list that went viral in the last few weeks. And we'll get philosophical. One of the precepts of our profession going back to the early 20th century is the idea of independence in reporting. But now there's a shift toward transparency. We'll talk about the difference. We'll also examine some of the top stories making news on the media beat, including an announcement from Twitter, on Twitter, of course, that the company is going public. Analysts estimate it could be valued at more than $10 billion, making it the biggest tech IPO since Facebook. But Facebook has had a bit of a rough ride since listing on the NASDAQ. We'll see what our panelists think. Could there be a lesson learned there? And National Public Radio names a new chief. At the same time, it announces there are going to be buyouts. The network is looking to reduce its staff by 10% and hopes to do it through voluntary separations. This, months after opening a brand new state-of-the-art headquarters in Washington, D.C. A lot to talk about in just about a half an hour, so let's go ahead and get started. Monday morning, military contractor and suspected Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis entered the installation using a pass that granted him full access. He had a gun he purchased legally in Virginia. And now 13 people are dead. We still don't know what his motive was behind that. CBS special correspondent and former FBI assistant director John Miller reports he was likely a disgruntled employee with anger management issues. And he had sought treatment from the VA in the past after hearing voices. It's a scene for reporters and viewers alike that's becoming all too familiar.
What do the shots sound like?
It was like pow, pow, pow. And then a few seconds it stopped, and then it pow, 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 pow. So we just ran.
Do you hear how many there were? How many shots there were?
I counted at least seven when I was there. I don't even know if I want to come back into the building again. I don't feel safe.
Just as we saw with the Boston Marathon bombing and the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut last winter, the media made some missteps in the early coverage of this story. Only the critics aren't too patient with journalists anymore. Gawker posted an open letter to readers entitled, "Next Time, Just Ignore the Breaking News." Craig Silverman wrote an article for Pointer with the headline, "This is my story about breaking news errors that just happened." What is it about covering stories like this that we can't ever seem to learn from our mistakes?
Well, I think part of the issue there is that we're trying to get on first. I mean, it's one of those things that keeps coming up over and over. You could go back to Boston. You could go to the Aurora shootings. You can go back to what happened in Fort Hood. You have media and journalists who show up at the scene, and they're trying to get information out to the public as quickly as possible. And sometimes they get ahead of themselves in trying to identify someone or in trying to present that information before it's been vetted through the proper law enforcement channels or even through their own processes.
I would agree with Ernest, but I think that what's happened is the news cycle has gone over time from a 24-hour news cycle to a half-day news cycle to a six-hour news cycle. It's now this microscopic, minute-by-minute news cycle where the perceived gains of getting out there even a small fact before some other outlet outweigh the necessity to be cautious.
So here's an example of one thing that happened on Monday, and we can discuss whether you think this was a misstep or if this was actually a successful moment. Don Andres, a legislative aide to a Nevada representative, describes what he witnessed Monday to MSNBC's Chris Jansen.
As I come around the corner, I noticed, folks are definitely scared. I see police boats in the water. And I set the drive up New Jersey, and right on New Jersey M is where I took a couple photos. There was a man lying on the corner just across from the metro, across from the DOT. And you see people are definitely scared. The police are just arriving. They're putting the caution tape on. I don't know what happened to the man. I don't know if it's related. All I know is that people just began running up to him and tending to him. And people were definitely scared, and so was I.
During that phone interview, MSNBC showed the photos Andres described, photos that the Associated Press put out on its wires and then later pulled back, saying it couldn't verify the incident shown in the photos were directly related to the Navy Yard shooting. What is your first response, Judd, when you see that? Is that a success or is that a failure in coverage?
I think it's a successful failure. As we move into more and more crowdsourced content, I think we're going to see this more and more. AP has had, at least for the last few years, pretty stringent ideas about what goes out on the web and what goes out on the wire, and it's always been backed up by having their own staff verify. In this case, you have something that couldn't be verified by their own staff, but they put it out on the wire to be out there first, and then they brought it back. But it was widely published in between the time it was sent out and the time it was recalled.
And I think it just goes back to that whole adage, you know, that you want to be first. You want to have that information out there first. And sometimes you don't stop and think about what are the ramifications if this is wrong. And in today's environment, once you put it out there, it's out there. Somebody has taken it. They either got a screenshot or they pulled it down. So you can retract it, but it's still going to be there because somebody has already pulled it and they're using it for whatever reason they're going to use it for.
So we had talked about how widely this photo had been published in the 5 or 6 hours it was available on the wire. Is there a hit that a news agency takes for having published it and then having to retract that photo? Is there a different level of, I don't know, criticism that comes with publishing a photo that may be erroneous as opposed to a fact?
I think a lot of it depends on the person that's getting it. I mean, the younger generation sort of understands that they've seen this happen over and over again. But when you start looking at people who have been with the media for a while, they're sort of the traditionalist. They expect it to be right the first time you put it out there. And when it's not, it damages your credibility with them. And like I said, with the younger generation, they expect updates and they expect the story to change over time. With the older, more traditional population or audience, they're looking for that information to be correct the first time around.
And I agree with Ernest. I think that our younger generation is a culture of revision, and they're used to this. I think the traditional users of news aren't. But I think 2 weeks from now, who but us will remember that AP had to recall something?
That's true. And the same thing with tweets. I think MSNBC was one of Chuck Todd mm-hmm. was there, and he was sending out information. And I think we have that on our blog. Mm-hmm. You would see this, and then all of a sudden he would retract. He put something out, and then he retracted again. So if you're following him on Twitter, then you understand this is what he's doing. But if MSNBC had decided to put that up to the television audience, then all of a sudden you've got the traditional audience to go like, wait a minute, why is he going back and forth and back and forth? I mean, that just raises a whole bunch of red flags in their eyes.
So as you're bringing up information that people had been tweeting during the developments going on in real time, one of the things that we saw happening again in this incident on Monday was television stations going ahead and tweeting information they were getting off of police scanners. Explain to our audience why that may not be the best practice.
Because police talk, and it's not always intelligent. We saw in Boston, the police scanner actually was refeeding information that a dispatcher saw on Twitter and ended up in misidentification of subjects. Police scanners are helpful reporting tools, but they're better off when we don't report necessarily what's on there because they're inaccurate.
Yeah, as a reporter, when you're monitoring the scanner, you're trying to get information that gets you to the scene, that gives you some background. But there's conversations, there's interviews, there's information from other places that you need to get in order to provide the full story. If you present that scanner information out there as the only source of information you have, then it's unfiltered and it doesn't really present a clear picture for the audience. And it can be inaccurate in a lot of cases.
Okay. Well, here's another situation of media behaving badly. BuzzFeed, the site has had some explosive growth over the course of the past two and a half years. And face it, some of the lists it produces can inform as well as entertain. But folks there last week learned viral content doesn't come cheap. It's all because of this photo. It's a child holding a juice box using what appears to be wings. Those wings are triangular corners that you find on the sides of a juice box. The photo was part of the list 18 everyday products you've been using wrong, compiled by staffer Gabby Noon. It offers advice on how to more efficiently use things that we have in our everyday lives, like those paper ketchup cups and fast food restaurants, toilet seat covers, pipe cleaners, and the like. To date, the list has more than 4.3 million page views and more than 350,000 likes on Facebook. But if you were to look at that list today, you would see that there's been a change to it. That picture of the child holding the juice box is gone. That's because the photographer who made that image, who took that photo, claimed his copyright and demanded that BuzzFeed paid him for use of the photo. He also wrote a rather pointed complaint published by Slate that you can read on our links blog. BuzzFeed has since made a $500 donation to a charity in the photographer's name. But this is something we often have to remind our students about. We often have to remind working professionals about. You can't just right-click on something that you see on the internet and republish it.
Yeah, it belongs to someone else. And it's their work, and they should be given the right where to put that information. If they want it to be out there for public access, that's fine. But they get credit for it, and they should get credit for it, either monetary or at least say, you know, this person presented this photo. And I think it goes back to a larger issue of copyright and the understanding of copyright. And I think in today's internet environment, there's not a lot of education being done about copyright and when it can be enforced and when it can't be.
So let's talk about that for a second. Explain the difference in what fair use is versus public domain and when we do as journalists have the ability to republish something.
Well, public domain is when a creative work is placed out there for the public's good. Sometimes it's because it's paid for with tax dollars. Any photo taken by a U.S. government agency, for instance, is in the public domain. Many times artists will put things out in the public domain because they want to, or when the copyright has expired some number of years after death. Fair use means that you can use portions of copyrighted work, but only certain portions of copyrighted work and only for certain reasons. In the case of BuzzFeed, we looked at all the tests that the Title 17 of the U.S. Code, which is the copyright portion of the U.S. Code, lays out, and it fails all of them for reuse of it in terms of fair use. It wasn't transformative. It was done for profit and the other six or seven tests that are in there.
Yeah, I think it goes back to if you're not sure about whether or not it is fair use or not, then you need to check it out and before you put it up online. But I think that we've gotten into this environment now where we can download everything or we can upload everything. So we figure that, hey, it's there. It's fair use. Well, I think BuzzFeed found out that's not the case. But like you said, this isn't the first time that it's happened. And I think that it's going to continue to happen. I mean, you're only talking about a $500 donation. Mm-hmm. Well, the next time it could be a heck of a lot more, and they could wind up finding themselves in court, okay, having to deal with that.
So let me ask you guys, do we support this photog? Are we applauding him for the approach he's taken here?
Well, I think he did the right thing and just pointing it out. And he didn't ask for a huge compensation. Yeah. But I think he was sending a message that BuzzFeed and others are going to have to be a lot more careful about taking what is clearly someone else's work and just putting it up there for their own advantages. And they are receiving monetary compensation because they're running ads for it.
I think that we have to support them. We have to support people who defend their creative works. What was so interesting here, though, is that the photographer said, well, yeah, you credited me. And BuzzFeed said, well, we credited you. Shouldn't that be enough? But simply credit under copyright law isn't enough compensation.
Judd, you did mention one thing when we started talking about this, about it there being transformative work, and it just kind of begs the question, we should talk about it. There's a lot of content we use here in this program that we share sound bites with you or different images that we've seen, and there's that question of, well, we didn't create that content. How is it we get to do that? It's because we're providing critique and we're discussing media criticism. Can you just kind of explain for a second to our audience exactly how that works and why that's okay?
Well, one of the reasons why it's okay is because we're talking about it in the environment of it being a critique. And the other issue is that we're not using the entire footage. If you wind up using that entire footage and you're receiving some sort of monetary compensation for that, and you're not compensating the person that did it, now you're running into those issues.
Okay, so here's another ethical question for you both. At the turn of the last century, when Walter Williams wrote The Journalist's Creed, he concluded that missive by saying, "The journalism that succeeds the best, fears God and honors man, is stoutly independent and, among other things, unmoved by pride of opinion or greed of power." He called it constructive and tolerant, but never careless. That's been the way we've been teaching journalism here since 1908, but our industry seems to be shifting some, moving away from a commitment of independence to a commitment of transparency. Transparency suggests it's okay for a journalist to have political leanings, just be honest about them. Some reporters, like The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald, have an agenda. That's okay, make that agenda known. Where do you guys sit on this?
Well, as an historian, I can tell you, we've had advocacy journalism from the founding of this country, and what you're seeing now is that advocacy journalism is playing out in what we would normally call the traditional or the mainstream media more and more, because the stories are being pushed by these advocacy journalists, and they're finding outlets, and those outlets are online, and now some of them have moved into the mainstream. So I think that this whole independence transparency issue is sort of, it's always been there, but now you're starting to see it more and more in the open, and you have mainstream journalists now saying that they want to be transparent about the way in which, you know, they have political leanings or how they feel about certain things, whereas in the past they wouldn't necessarily do that.
I think that there's an honesty issue here, and I think that this is good if we talk about transparency in the framework of honesty. Because for years, the traditional media, the mainstream media, has always said, well, of course we're fair and of course we're objective. And it's possible to be fair, but we know that we're not necessarily objective because mm-hmm. we all have Sorry. Our own lenses. And so as we talk about transparency, it allows us to say, this is the lens through which I see this particular event or this sequence of events. So I think this is ultimately going to be a good thing.
But in being transparent, they also have to, I think, accurately and fairly present the other sides of the story and sort of try to get away from this, one side says this, one side says that, so now we're presenting these two sides to the audience. Stories are a lot more complex as people's lives are a lot more complex, and we have to be honest about how we as journalists feel about that complexity and also present how those stories have an impact not only on society but on individuals as well.
This is an evolution, just as we saw the original newspapers in the United States being basically political organs, and then we moved into this period of independence and objectivity, and now we're moving back into more of sort of an advocacy or transparency area. It will evolve into something else where we're no longer polarized as we cover the issue, and then we'll see what happens then, and then there'll be some evolution after that.
But do we risk, when you say no longer being polarized on an issue, do we risk perhaps not having that fairness built in, maybe not telling every one of those sides of the story if a reporter is coming at a story from having had a point of view or from having had that that bias, and just putting it out on the table ahead of time and making it clear may not be enough to still get that balanced story?
But here's the deal. The journalist is recognizing his or her bias mm-hmm. and recognizing the impact that that bias can have on a particular story that they're working on. And they're letting the audience know that this is their bias. But they're also letting their sources know this as well. As long as that bias doesn't seep into the journalism to the point where it changes that story from the authentic story that it is, then I think it's fair. You're being openly and honest with both your sources, with both your audience and with yourself about where the story is going and how it actually got to that point.
I agree completely. I think that as long as we're honest with the audience, as long as we're honest with the sources, then the story is the story. But people all the time hew to news outlets that are reflective of their political views. Every Pew study ever done on readership seems to show this. Yeah. And this is just a continuation of that.
Well, let's shift gears a bit here and talk about some of the big stories on the media beat this week. One of the biggest, making headlines, has done so in 140 characters or less. That's the announcement from Twitter in a tweet that the company is planning to go public. It has filed the required paperwork with the Securities and Exchange Commission to have an initial public offering and sell stock. It's estimated the company will be valued at more than $10 billion and will be the biggest tech IPO since Facebook listed on the NASDAQ in May 2012. Judd, what does this filing mean?
Well, it means, because of the way that they filed, that Twitter's annual revenue right now is under $1 billion a year. We know that because of the confidential S-1 filing that they did. It means that the company didn't really want a lot of revisions in their initial filings to be public. And there were questions about accounting, which is something that we saw with Groupon, something that we saw with Facebook. But what it means for you and I and Ernest and everyone who uses Twitter is that we'll probably see some changes in the news feed as there's a push from investors to monetize the news feed a little bit more for, you know, stock returns or share returns, and it means that there'll probably be a push on the back end that we don't see to do more with the large amount of use data and user data that Twitter accumulates, much as we saw with Facebook.
Okay. How soon do you think we could be buying and selling stock in Twitter?
Probably by the end of the year is a good estimation. It could go into the first quarter of 2014. But one of the things that's so interesting about the filing of the S-1 when they announced it in this tweet on September 12th is they said, we filed the paperwork. It wasn't, we filed the paperwork today. So they could go tomorrow and announce that they're in their three-week period of public disclosure before the investment roadshow when they go out and look for underwriting, when they go out and look for investors.
Do you think this Twitter going public could change how we're using Twitter? You've talked a little bit about the experience and what it might look like from the news feed side, but will it change the way we use the product at all, do you think?
I think that it might. I think that when Facebook became a public company and began changing more significantly and more often their own terms of use and the usability and the interface, people would always get mad and they'd say, well, I'm not going to use it anymore. And it turns out it really hasn't affected it all that much. On the other hand, if we see drastic changes to where the timeline becomes secondary to the advertisements in there, and if the user experience becomes much less pleasant, I think that we'll see it potentially go away. Or not go away, but we'll see people leave and the influence of the service weaken.
I think it's they're going to have to figure out new ways to monetize it. Because that's what the shareholders are going to want. And this is one of the things that Facebook faced and continues to face right now, is that whenever you go into to that advertising stream as a way of reaching a certain level of stock price and return on investment for the shareholders, then you also turn off a certain segment of your audience of people who have bought into it because they were trying to get away from that. And you wind up losing people, and then all of a sudden you could reach this threshold where, you know, this is as far as it's going to go. But I think, at least from the initial indication, that Twitter is going to far outreach that. If it's going to get to the level of Facebook, I'm not sure. And I'm hoping that by them going in this direction that it doesn't head in that same direction of sort of leveling off like Facebook did.
Well, we'll see what happens in the coming weeks and months with that. National Public Radio made news late last week, too. Friday afternoon, the network's CEO announced it would be offering voluntary buyouts to employees with the hope of cutting its staff by 10%. There are currently about 840 full and part-time employees at NPR. And according to reports, anyone with at least 3 years of service is eligible for the buyout. Why do we think this is happening? Why now?
Well, I think what's happening is that with NPR, they've done some reshuffling. They moved some positions around. They have the new building in Washington, but then they've also moved out west. So they have a facility out there, and I think that this buyout is one of those issues where they don't want to lay off people, but they're going to have to do something in terms of leveling out their employee base, especially on the new side.
I mean, this is what's happening everywhere else, and why should National Public Radio be exempt from reorganizing, reshuffling, changing things around? The fact that they built a $200 million building, and their annual budget is $174 million. Notwithstanding, they're trying to change the same way that everyone else in the industry is trying to change.
Well, and that is one thing that some of the media have been bringing up. I know there's a story on the Washington Post that's on our links blog that specifically asked this question, the idea of, with this fancy new headquarters, are there cracks in the funding model? Are we beginning to see those coming through here?
I don't think so. I mean, I actually toured the new building, and it is marvelous. But I also remember the old building. I've been there on several times, and that place is a dump.
It was a barn.
They really needed to move out of there.
Okay.
So, and I know there's been a lot of criticism about the new building and why build this new building if you knew you were going to have to do all this restructuring and buying people out and that sort of thing. But whenever you build a new building, you're going to try to make it as efficient and as pleasant a place as possible, because you're going to have people working there all the time, especially in the newsroom. Mm-hmm. They're almost 24/7.
Yeah.
So I don't understand all the criticism about the new building, especially if you'd seen the old one. And you're trying to build a bigger and better operation. You're going to want to have a nice building, I would think.
Well, and I think that's exactly right. We all like to work in nice places. I think that instead of showing cracks in the funding model, this shows how it works. We have a $200 million building that was built with donations and taking advantage of the nonprofit and almost governmental status of NPR, in that it was mainly financed with tax-free bonds. So,
and also the threat of moving to Silver Springs, Maryland, forced D.C. to give them some tax abatements.
Yeah, there's $40 million in tax abatements, right, on that building. And so this shows that instead of using operational budget funds to build the building, their business model and their funding model allowed them to build this building.
Okay. Well, we should note, just to avoid any confusion, you're listening to us on KBIA or watching us on KBIA.org. KBIA is a University of Missouri licensed public radio station. It has been a National Public Radio member station since the early 1970s, but also carries programming from Public Radio International, American Public Media, and other national and local sources. Before we go, there was a series of opinion pieces in several national newspapers this week and some extensive reporting in the New York Times looking at the issue of equality. Ernest, you kind of brought this to our attention and wanted to talk about this a little bit. Tell us what we're seeing there.
Well, one of the reasons I want to bring it up is because what you're starting to see in the news media across the country is a growing sort of movement in terms of looking at inequality and what that means. And I think what the news media is starting to become aware of is that the outgrowth of the economy, the Great Recession, what's happened there, the Wall Street movement that occurred, you're starting to see some of that because you're seeing the stagnation at certain levels of our economy. And the news media is starting to pick up on that. And I think the New York Times is doing a great, and it's on our blog, is doing a great series this year on what they call the Great Divide, looking at it from various angles. And I just wanted to bring that up to our readers and our viewers and our listeners, our viewers, that they might want to start looking at this, because it will be a big issue in the upcoming congressional elections, and it will definitely be an issue in the 2016 elections.
This is why we need a robust media in this country to not only cover the breaking stories like the Washington Navy Yard shootings, but to find these broader thematic stories. And the New York Times has done a fantastic job on this. And I think this is a perfect example of why we need great people.
Okay, well, we will be keeping an eye on that series and looking for what themes we can continue to bring up and talk about on this show as a result of that reporting. That music means we're just about out of time. There's more background for all of today's topics on our links blog under the talk show tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there, or send them to us in an email. Our address is views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. Mike McKean will be back with Ernest and me for another edition of Views of the News.